This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Show number 256, the Tuesday, August 1st edition. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you from Saratoga, finally, from the little house on the east side, hanging out with Muggs, the handicapping Labrador. Very happy to be joined today by a special guest who doesn't feel like a guest. He feels like a proper co-host, and that's probably because he was the original host slash co-host of this very program. I'm talking about DRF's own Matt Bernier, of course. Matt, how are you today?
What's going on, boys? How are we doing?
Doing extremely well. And we are joined also, as always, calling in from the planet Texas, but not for long. Fresh back from a trip to Del Mar, he's, of course, the people's champ, Jonathan Kitchen. JK, how'd it go out there in Cali?
The weather was nice.
That bad, huh? that's your lead.
I've not had a good Del Mar, but and neither is Bob Baffert, so I guess we just must have something in common, huh? With the gray wig and the silver hair wig probably has rubbed off on me. It's kind of like a wand in some sorcerer movie. Whoever has it is in trouble. So
you might need to send that into the haberdasher or whoever it is to get it repowdered or something. Maybe you can bust it out in the run up to the Breeders' Cup. Hard to see Baffert staying on the canvas for very long.
I've actually already packed it. I'm bringing my Chad Brown wig to Saratoga.
More of a cap, I think we decided for the capture that correctly. Quite a weekend for Chad Brown. What was it at one point? He had the 8 of 9 races in a row with multiple exactas in that stretch across multiple tracks. Just an unreal example of the phrase that we break out from time to time. It's Chad Brown's world. We're just living in it. So much to unpack from the weekend. Before we get to the racing results, though, JK, I want to pause on Del Mar for at least a minute, do a little quick tournament talk about the Del Mar contest, and also talk about some cool stuff going on DRF tournaments this weekend. But give us the quick run. Doesn't sound like it's going to be a long story, but give us the quick rundown of your tournament history and what ended up happening out there.
Well, the first thing I need to say is Farron McCubbins. If you don't know who he is, he's a name you should start to recognize because he won the Belmont Challenge and he blew the field away in the Del Mar Challenge as well. And he paid for our tab in the Hilton Bar after he won $185,000. One of those unannounced, can we get our check? Oh, and that gentleman already got it for you situation. So that's always an admirable trait. But I had an opportunity where I played doubles coming out of the race with Ransom the Moon and Dre Fong. I used those two horses and 6 horses in the last. And if any of those 6 would have won, I would have been at about $11,000 to $12,000 to $13,000. And the one horse beat me, who in his last race was loose on like a 23 quarter going down the hill at Santa Anita. I don't bet horses like that. And that horse beat me, and the tournament was over on day one, and had a good dinner to follow it up. But that was about it.
There were a lot of interesting storylines. Garrett Skiba becoming, I think, I'm almost positive, the first player to ever connect for 4 6-figure scores in tournaments. He ran second, closing bank around 40, got another 60 back, plus the seats. Super impressive. McCubbins.
He's living right, by the way. He's living right. He is a photo-winning sucker, boy, I tell you what.
That's amazing. What else? McCubbins gets now his second shot at $1 million bonus. The Belmont contest had $1 million bonus for the Breeders' Cup, too. Another interesting story, and this is one I wanted to ask you about, Matt, your old castmate from Horse Players, Christian Helmers, himself with a tournament resume, especially in live bank play, but really in all tournaments, as long as your arm. He was right there on day one, might have even been the day one leader, built his bankroll up big, and it seemed like he must have made an all-in play in either the 7th or 8th races on Sunday to go after McCubbins. It didn't work out. He ended up busting out. But your wagering personality in live bankroll play, what do you think about that bold all-in move, the sort of win or go home attitude in live bankroll play?
Well, I put it this way. When I was, with Christian on a normal basis while we were doing the show, I kind of learned it. And who knows, in the past 3 years, maybe his, or 4 years, maybe his approach has changed. But I know he is like a major proponent of, at some point, you've got to dump it. You've got to go for it because that's the only way that you're going to get the job done. I guess I don't want to say it's a conservative standpoint from my point of view, but I'd like to at least have a minor amount going into the finale, knowing that, crazy things can happen. We've seen in the Breeders' Cup betting challenge that the final race, the classic, more often than not, someone wins with some sort of a win bet or an exacta or whatever it may end up being. So I kind of have one or two races in a live bankroll event that I kind of hone in on and say, I'll throw just a percentage out there. 85 or 90% of my money, I'm going into these two with it. Whether I'm right or wrong, I still want to have something that I can maybe just take a swing and hopefully hit a home run in the finale. And whether it's good enough to win or not remains to be seen. But at least I've got something to take a small stab with. But I can understand anyone that says, if you find that one race that you love, go at it. Send it in. And at that point, if you're right, you're going to be in great position. And if you're wrong, you can drink the rest of the day.
Here's my thing. Yeah, absolutely. Here's my question. And we were trying to figure it out without too much detective work. But I don't understand how you bet $20,000 into like the middle of the race, the middle of the card race at Del Mar, without like really betting against yourself. I mean, what do you bet $30,000 on?
I don't know. I was hoping you could tell me, JK. I haven't gotten that information yet. I'm sure if we reached out to him.
There was $56,000 because I thought he bet the double out. I thought he bet like doubles out. There's $56,000 in the double, which was about the average for the day and the weekend on in the double pool. So he didn't bet the double. I mean, there was I can't remember exactly. I think there was like 250, 300 maybe in the win pool. I can't remember exactly, but it's still – I was just curious, not so much what he played, but like how he found a way to where he felt like – because he's a smart guy.
I'm sure he found a way to get his money in good. If there's one thing we know about Christian, it's that. Further research is required. I was honestly hoping you would have heard the story out there and be able to share it. But how about this question, though? And I'll ask you first, JK, but Matt, feel free to chime in. What about the idea of going for broke like that? I mean, to be in a position where you could have a in-the-money finish, a top-five finish, clearly not worried about that at all. Yes, the purse structure is outsized, $100,000 extra money to first, $60,000 to second. Obviously, it goes down from there. Then there's this $1 million bonus in play. But then also, we know Christian. He's a competitive guy. It seems like the kind of guy who – and with a few high-profile seconds on his resume, probably not eager to repeat that in a major tournament. I'm just curious what you thought of the go for broke decision. Do you feel like you can justify it from a risk reward point of view, JK?
Yeah, I can. I mean, I think if you turn five into 30 or 35 or 40 or whatever he got up to, and then you decide to risk 15, 20, 25 to get another 100, it kind of makes sense to me. I mean, you have to treat, at least I've always done it. I mean, I guess you don't have to, but I've always treated dollars in live bankroll tournaments as bullets. I don't treat them as dollars. They're bullets. They're there to accomplish the goal of winning that extra money in the pot. When you play parimutuelly, those are dollars. But when you're playing in that situation, I treat them as bullets. And so I have no problem firing bullets when you're in the middle of a war.
It's a very, very sensible idea. It's going to be very interesting to see now McCubbins with two chances at $1 million. Somebody's going to hit one of these seven-figure bonuses one day, and then that player, whoever it is, McCubbins being the most likely right now, will become the second horse player to have a seven-figure score, joining today's birthday boy and another person who's in this festival of horse player birthdays happening this week, including Mr. Bernier and myself. Michael Bachok with the $1 million moniker. It'll be very, very interesting to see. It could happen as soon as this year's Breeders' Cup. Going to be a fun story to follow. Another fun story to follow in the tournament world is this World Championship of Handicapping, which continues to build momentum. A lot of the contests on DRF tournaments are circling around that. Very interesting opportunity this week. Wednesday and Thursday on DRF tournaments, it's an all Saratoga lineup, races 2 through 10 both days. Not only that, this is the first time DRFT has run one of their grade one qualifiers for the World Championship of Handicapping back to back. So in the past, because there's been 3 weeks of run-up, these fields have been at least 25 players or more in the grade ones. With only 4 days of play between these two, it's conceivable you could have as few as 10 entries competing for the $5,000 seat to the $1 million no takeout finals. Matt, as a tournament player, is that something that you look at when you're entering a tournament? Not just the buy-in, not just the prize, but the ratio of prizes to entries and the total amount of players? Does that factor into your decision-making?
I tell you what, if it doesn't, I think you're probably approaching it the wrong way. Anytime that you can get the lower the ratio, the better, or put it the other way around. The more likely chance of you getting in and qualifying, even if it does entail having a higher buy-in, I think that's something that you have to consider. I mean, I understand, like this past weekend, the NHC free tournament. I understand, look, it's free, so you can't really complain about it, but 5 out of 2,700. I mean, percentage-wise, we're talking about a minuscule number. The likelihood of that working out is not something, that's not a positive expectation, other than the fact that it was a free buy-in. Now, when you talk about one of these sort of feeders or whatever other kind of contest it may be, yeah, I mean, what would you prefer? Would you rather buy in for 100 and have to run the top 1 or 2 out of 200? Or would you rather buy in for 400 and have to run in the top 1 or 2 for 25? I mean, I would always take the lower number as far as the overall field size is concerned and have to put up a little bit more up front.
JK, you have resisted so far getting involved in the WCH qualifying action because you've had some other more near-term goals, such as the Del Mar contest. Does the possibility of playing for this seat for $1 million with no takeout against potentially only 9 other players, is that going to get you involved on this Saturday for the 580?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked a lot. Well, it just depends. I'm a hands full a little bit. I'm going to be playing. I'm going to be helping someone in the Wynn tournament from a distance from an annoying birthday celebration, but I will, like I told you guys before, like, you know, I know it sounds kind of it comes off arrogant, but please don't misunderstand it. When it's the ratio's tough, when it's 1 in 40, 1 in 50, 1 in 60, my game, the way I play, I need a lot of chances at that because I need a low scoring day. When it's 140 points or whatever, I don't win those. So I need to try a lot when it's those higher ratios. When it's the lower ratios, I can win those days. I can play 4 to 5 shots that I think are going to win. I can play 3 to 1 shots. 10 to 1 shots, people might not have them when there's 1 in 10. So I feel very confident that when I actually sit down to try to qualify for the $1 million no takeout, I'll be able to do it. So I'm not feeling like I'm in a rush. I feel panic with the 1 in 40s and the 1 in 50s and the 1 in 60s because those take me a lot of chances to accomplish something.
Oh, well, if you can work it into your busy schedule over the weekend, perhaps your name will be up on that leaderboard. Going to be a lot of fun. I've met some players just at the Paddock Bar this year. Been encouraging them to get involved in tournaments and have some success stories. I'll be writing about one of them a little bit later this week on drf.com. Check it out. Lots of fun stuff going on there. And of course, all your tournament activity, tournaments.drf.com, especially those all Saratoga lineups Wednesday and Thursday. A quick tournament question that came in from a listener. We're going to hit that, and then we will segue and start talking about our thoughts about the crazy three-year-old division and all the racing action from the weekend. But this one came in over the transom. If you know there's a track bias, would you expect that live tournaments on that day would have more people participating than in the all-in format? Maybe another way to ask the same question, and we'll start with you, Matt, is would it affect whether or not you wanted to change your picks if you suspected that there was a track bias on the day?
Yes, 100%. For me, anyway. Now, again, I'm the wrong person to talk to about track bias because I'll probably be the last person in the room to finally buy in or admit that there may be something with the racetrack going on. But I, you know, with an all-in format, first and foremost, I'm not particularly strong with the all-in. It's just not something that I enjoy. Just because if somebody clips off a capper, I feel like I'm already, unless I run the table or go real, you know, 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10, I'm probably not going to be in good position after that. You factor in all of a sudden, if after race three, everyone can see that inside and speed is gold, and you've already put your picks in, you're kind of up, you know what's creek. I mean, there's no way that you can change that, as opposed to a live sort of format where, okay, I can adapt on the fly and say, you know what, I liked this horse before the day. Now I see how this racetrack has been playing, and I know I have no chance if I stick with that horse, and at least you have the ability to call an audible. It's a conundrum for any kind of contest, whether it's all in, whether it's live money. I mean, it's, I don't know if you guys agree or disagree. To me, that's one of the things that can turn new people off to the game in a heartbeat, is if all of a sudden you say, oh, by the way, the track today is wonky. The track is not, it's not a fair track today. And they can look at you and go, well, what do you mean it's not fair? Well, you know, sometimes it happens. Sometimes a track is tilted one way or the other. And they look at me and go, this is just, you know, common knowledge? And people just accept it? And I say, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it happens. And to me, it's still one of the biggest problems in this game. It's not fair to the bettors. It's not fair to the connections with these horses that you think that you're going to get a fair racetrack, then you don't get it. And it's not fair to contest players either.
Well, let's start. Let's segue on. Let's grab this bias bull by the horn since it came up now. I was going to talk about it later. Was there a bias at Saratoga this weekend?
Yes, I believe there was. And I believe that the most misleading part of that whole thing that I think will throw people off the most is that Good Samaritan came rallying from out of it in the middle of the track. But one of the biggest things you have to realize and one of the most important things you have to watch is the head-on. And you'll notice that Good Samaritan spent a majority of the race on the inside of the track. And while those other horses were not picking up their feet when they came from home, he was the only one that, you know, it was kind of a perfect storm. He was actually one that was going to be running late, but he's also going to be running a lot better than everyone else because he had saved all that ground on the best part of the track.
It was surprising to see him coming that wide, but when you do watch the replay, I agree with your assessment. He was on the right part of the track as building momentum and then sort of was able to cut over to make the wide move. So I don't think that we had a question coming in, actually. Would you call him against the bias or did the track change? And my answer to that, similar to JK's, would be neither. Now, I did think there was an inordinate amount of chatter in racing Twitter about this bias, given that while there were certain results that definitely made me think there was a bias, especially in real time, as I went back, there were a lot of things that could be explained by circumstance. Now, not all of them. Certainly that Finger Lakes horse winning wire to wire yesterday, I thought, you know, the pace figures that I look at, that horse shouldn't have had the finish that was demonstrated, which made me think bias. El Deal winning by the length of the stretch in real time made me think bias. But at least in the case of El Deal, when you look back at that and the horse outsprints Green Grotto early and gets that position, and this isn't the first time we've seen Navarro on a big day have a horse run out of its skin 20 points better than anything, and you factor in even if it was just a good rail, not necessarily a huge bias, and you get to be that alone. Anyway, I think you can hear where I'm going with this. The other point I want to make about the bias, and then, Matt, I want to get your buy-in on this. You're going to be the perfect person to ask as someone who doesn't knee-jerk conclusion go to bias the way that that so many do. A lot of the speed horses weren't rail speed. There was a lot of two-wide, three-wide, jockeys okay with letting horses to the inside. I don't think it was – even though it looked like a paved highway rail almost in the Good Samaritan run. A lot of the winds weren't stuck down there on the rail. So what is your opinion, Matt? Huge bias, little bias, somewhere in between with a lot of circumstance. What's your read when you go back and look at the results from last weekend?
Well, so here's the thing for me. And again, I'm probably the right and the wrong person to be talking about this just because I don't pick up on it as quickly as other people do. And I'm reluctant to buy into it. But I look at the results from Saturday and so many of these horses on dirt. I'm looking at the opener right now. The winner was 4-5, which was Mojo Nation, who we'll talk about him in a little bit. The third race, the winner was 1-2. The fifth race, the winner was 3-5. The seventh race was Turf. The eighth race was the Vanderbilt. El Deal figured. He was 5-2. I didn't think he would run a hole in the wind, but he did. And the Jim Dandy, that's sort of the one that you've got to make the determination on. The thing for me, that it's just, it seems like all of those horses, they're all figured. So, I mean, was it really a bias, or were these horses just supposed to do what they did?
Right. I mean, what makes me think bias a little is the way some horses, now I should have checked this before I said it, but like in my head, Limousine Liberal, like, should have run really well and had kind of an against the track trip. There were some negative performances that I might be willing to excuse on the possibility of a bias, but I don't think it's as cut and dry. If you just look at, you know, I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess if there were five dirt races on Saturday, four were wire to wire and the other was Good Samaritan with the rail. And then again, yesterday, I think there were about four or five dirt races. And I think again, four or five, all wire to wire. It almost seems irrefutable, but then like Matt just did, you go back and you look through the charts and they all kind of figured. I don't know, JK, what do you think? Is it possible that some of the races were the track was definitely dictating the results? Is it possible that's a bit of an exaggeration?
Well, I think that you need to do some, there's still some, probably some trip work that needs to be done from the weekend,
sure.
but I will say this. I think that a lot of times, and even more often than not, the bias is more easily identified by looking at not the winners of the races, but the horses that don't run as well or other like also rans. When you can find a horse that ran third that should still be running, but that horse was on the inside the entire time. You know what I mean? I think that I find those to be a lot more, a lot stronger indicators, because like you said, I mean, Mojovation was going to win no matter what, right? So it doesn't really matter where he was in that spot. And, he, you know, him winning wire to wire should not, you know, make people run to the window to bet the 99-1 shot is going to be on the rail in the next race. But however, you can look at the also rans and the horses that didn't run well as strong indicators of when a bias might exist.
See, well, that's a question that I had, and I didn't mean to interrupt Pete.
No, like, you go ahead.
You go through and you look. So that's the thing for me where I look at it and go, all right, all these horses, they did most of their running on the front end, but you also look at some of the horses that ran second in these races. You know, in the third race, the starter allowance, Kirby's Penny was 1-2, wired the field. The runner-up was 30-1, and at the second call, he was fifth, and he was 3.5 lengths off the pace. So is it speed or was it inside? Because then you go to a race like the Amsterdam with Excitations. He was on the inside the whole way, but he came from basically last. So that's the thing for me that I just kind of get torn saying, you know, is it inside or is it speed? And also knowing that inside is going to inherently play to speed, because generally if you clear to the front, you're going to be on the inside. But then, Pete, you brought up the point that some of the speeds were in the 2 or 3 path. So again, this is why for me, with a bias situation, I just hate to immediately find it. And I know you can take advantage and make big scores. To me, the minute I buy into a bias, I throw out all the work that I've done, and it's kind of garbage.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really one of the most complex things in all of handicapping. I definitely believe it's an important factor, and I think there was something going on with the track. I just don't think it might be quite as cut and dried as some are making it out to be. JK makes a great point. Lots more work to be done. Today's Tuesday, the one day during Saratoga we can go back and look at some of these results. We'll probably follow up on this when some of these horses run back later in the meet. But for now, let's talk a little bit more about these stakes and these horses who ran on Saturday. Matt, what was your initial reaction in the aftermath of the Jim Dandy?
My initial reaction, if any of you follow me on Twitter, or if you don't, @Bernier_Matt, you can just look at the GIF that I posted. That was my initial reaction afterward. Just take the computer as if I were a monkey and throw it off the desk. Because, I mean, when Hunter O'Reilly's winning graded stakes races, nice horse, Jimmy Toner, great trainer. We know Hunter O'Reilly. When El Deal is not only winning a grade one, but he's winning by 15. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. But, I mean, you get what I'm saying. And then when the Derby and the Preakness winners are really, really bad, and a turf horse making his dirt debut, I get it. He's got some dirt pedigree, and they wanted to run him and all that. I understand. But when he blows the doors off the field, that's when I just kind of throw my hands up and go, I never had a chance on Saturday.
I had one of those frustrating days where horses I liked to run, you know, a lot of people don't do this and think I'm crazy for doing this, but a lot of times I'll try to split the hair and say, this is a horse I like to run third and fourth and maybe a little bit for second, but I'm not going to play to win. And that was my attitude about both Hunter O'Reilly and Good Samaritan. So then I watch them win, and it's hard not to steam a little bit about my own approach to the game sometimes. I was pretty surprised by both of those races. In the case of El Deal, I thought Green Grotto would put more pressure, and I love Limousine Liberal. I love them walking by, and that one just didn't quite work out for me. JK, what were your thoughts on the Saratoga Stakes on Saturday? We can go through them.
Well, Marvin, the famous bet runner Marvin from Las Vegas, was in town, and there's a word on the streets that he just likes to bet the five all the time.
So he hit sort of like our guest Anthony Robb, who won a seat to a major Vegas tournament betting all the ones. Now we've got Marv betting all the fives.
He had Hunter O'Reilly on Saturday. He had Good Samaritan, and then Eric Bilek, who's like his long lost son, who's a big Marvin fan, decided in the free NHC to play all fives and like was in the top five for a very long time. There was a 31-1 shot, one, a 6-1, a 9-1, a bunch of fives. So bet the five next weekend. No, I mean, look, El Deal was the one that kind of made me feel like the inside was where he wanted to be. And I'll be very excited to bet against El Deal on his next start. And hopefully he'll take a lot of money. They can run the race again. I can't find Hunter O'Reilly. It's just one of those results where I try not to spend too much time looking into it. There's still four horses in that race I think are better than that horse. I think that the jocks moved a little. It was a very weirdly run race. I felt like Javier moved too early on Sadler's Joy. It was a weird deal. So, and then the Jim Dandy, I was standing with Nick. We were watching it, Tamaro, and I said, if Always Dreaming doesn't win from here, this is right after they went to the backstretch, I said, he will never, ever, ever win again. And I stand by that. That horse will never win another race.
I don't think he'll ever run another race, JK.
Then he definitely won't win another one.
That's right. So you've got it right. The for me, Always Dreaming, after seeing the El Deal situation, I flipped from – I was going to make my Good Samaritan second, third, and fourth bet, and at that point I just said Always Dreaming on paper now to me, with as hot as Pletcher had been on the day on the track, I just sort of took Always Dreaming as a free square in the picks going forward. And then I saw him – I'll admit, I was in this new cool area at the Paddock Bar. I somehow managed to be chatting with somebody. I missed the horses walking by, which is a horrible thing to admit, but it's the kind of thing that happens at Saratoga. So I took extra care to watch them go into the gate, and I just did not like what I was seeing at all. And it was one of those things where there was just no way I was getting back to the window to cancel tickets. I would have.
And I don't think that Cloud Computing deserves any less criticism than Always Dreaming. He was awful too. But you know what? That's what happens, right? When you have a perfect trip, bias-aided winner of the Kentucky Derby, and a perfect trip, perfect setup, facing no-shows winner of the Preakness, then they come back, they get bet off the board, and then their true colors show. I don't think either one of them are that good. And I fell into the trap. I thought Cloud Computing was going to get the dream trip sitting right in the rail, right behind Always Dreaming, and he was going to be able to outfinish him, and they both were just very, very poor.
So, yeah, no doubt about it. Let's talk about the Haskell, the big three-year-old race on Sunday. We can always loop back to Saratoga if we have any more thoughts there. But I feel like we should just what you just said, JK, about the Preakness and Derby makes me think now is the time in the show where we need to talk about this three-year-old class. What did we learn about this three-year-old class in the Haskell map, Bernier?
Oh, boy, that it's still just as – it's clear as mud right now. you know, it's a situation where – look, you can make a case for a couple different horses in the Haskell and give them at least a mulligan for maybe some subpar efforts. Timeline, Practical Joke didn't do his uncoupled stablemate any favors when they broke from the gate and he sideswiped him and slammed him. And he was lit up like a Christmas tree going into the first turn, and he never shut down after that. I don't want to entirely hold that against Timeline just because we had seen what he was capable of doing before. Practical Joke, he ran his race going two turns. He just doesn't want to go that far. I know some people may disagree with the idea that Joel, you know, you kept him in a little bit too long in behind horses. But then again, I look at it and say he got the jump really on Gervin, and Gervin outfinished him. I think all that was just a matter of staying. McCracken, he ran a great race. I thought it was fine. I still think he's probably going to be, you know, a one turn miler. Maybe I would love them to go to the Alan Jerkins. I know they're talking about the Travers. I don't think a mile and a quarter works for him. Gervin, I think Gervin is, you know, Gervin's a nice horse. I don't think he's a superstar, but do you have to be a superstar to take control of this division right now after what we saw at Saratoga on Saturday? I don't think you do. And Irish War Cry continues to be the most perplexing horse of all of these kind of head scratchers because he'll run a really, really bang up race. And I don't care how much time off he has. He right now is the definition of an in and outer. And that was his out race. And guess what? If he showed up in the Travers, I'd be mildly intrigued because he'd be sitting on his good race.
Time for an in, and certainly in the kind of hands where if he shows up in that spot, I would trust that he's capable of performing. I heard a rumor there was a little rift in the bromance between J.K. and Bernier over the result of the Haskell. I heard J.K. did everything but steal your wallet to keep you from betting on the horse. Matt, any truth to that rumor? And any truth to that rumor? A, did you listen to him? B, and if so, have you forgiven him yet? C.
No, so when I'm looking at the race on Thursday night, going through the tape, and I watched the Ohio Derby again, and I said, you know what, I kind of felt like Gervin ran pretty well, because I didn't look at the Kentucky Derby as a real race for him, and if you, with all the foot problems and the wet track and all that, and if you just draw a line through that, the horse hadn't run since April 1st, so the fact that he got attacked by the Luch horses on the far turn and IRAP ran him down. And I heard Jonathan the other week say IRAP he's not a big fan of. I never have been either. But IRAP actually looked like a racehorse in the Indiana Derby. And I think all of a sudden he becomes he has every chance that any of these other horses do to run well in the Travers or wherever he shows up next. So I sent him a text and I said, hey, am I crazy for liking Gervin? And I said, just tell me I'm nuts. And he sent me the emoji of the peanuts. And that, to me, was all I needed to see. I said, that's fine. I just want someone to tell me that. It didn't get me off him. I still picked him. I bet him. And it worked out fine. But, look, this is a division where it's whoever wakes up feeling good that day that can take advantage. And, look, all of a sudden now we talk about West Coast. And maybe he doesn't want to go, you know, a mile and a quarter. I mean, if he shows up for the Travers, which it sounds like he's going to, doesn't he just, you know, look all automatically like he's one of the main contenders on paper?
I don't know, JK. You might have to get that that wig back from the haberdasher. What do you think?
Well, actually, Nick Tamaro is he asked me if he could borrow the wig. He's a very big West Coast supporter in this situation, and he's already confirmed that, you know, obviously despite the draw, He's gonna be placing a wager or two on West Coast. Yeah, I mean, I think two people, you know, owe apologies for the Haskell. And I called Matt and told him I didn't have to do it publicly because I didn't tell him he was nuts publicly. But I apologize for telling him he was nuts. The other person that owes an apology and would be Rajiv Marad. I don't understand how you break with a speed horse from the rail. The other speed horse who's outside of you misses the break, and then you somehow end up in the two path chasing the other speed horse who you let inside of you. And then you end up three wide like you're Johnny V on Uncle Mo looking through your legs like you're loaded. I that was a very, very curious ride to me, and it doesn't make a difference. I don't think he was winning either way.
You're talking about Irish War Cry, yes?
Absolutely, yeah, Irish War Cry. So
not the first time we've seen Rajiv make that move. I think I would never look back again on that horse, I think, would be my advice. should he be lucky enough to ride him again, I think I'd put that move away. I wouldn't bust that one out. It seems like bad luck.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I completely agree. You know, with Matt about Practical Joke and McCracken, how much fun would it be if they were running in the Allen Jerkins with Cole Front and you know, American Anthem, I think is supposed to be heading east, because it feels like Bob Baffert's probably never going to run a horse at Del Mar again.
You think we'll see him full time here at Saratoga next year?
There's a chance.
Yeah, right.
There's a big chance.
The king of New York at this point. Girvin, the great job by Matt picking Girvin. Girvin was also picked at the Naira Betts seminar that I was hosting in the Pavilion tent by Paul Matisse. You can still find that Periscope, and if you haven't seen it, I would. Great stuff from Chick Matisse and Paul Matisse. Great interaction between those guys. If you can ignore the host in the middle, you could have an entertaining half hour watching what those guys have to say.
My favorite line, Nick and I and John Nichols watched it as we ate breakfast at Del Mar, was it was a banter between them two where Chick said that Paul thinks he can bet every race and he's got to bet every track and blah blah blah, and he keeps telling him he can't do that, and then Paul tells Chick, well, I have more money than you.
That's the ultimate Trump.
giving Dad a hard time. Nice. Well, if you want to come see another one of those seminars, I recommend it next Saturday from 11 to 11:30. It's going to be this same crew reunited there in the Pavilion tent. Matt Bernier and JK will join me. We're going to have a lot of fun. And that's not our only media appearance of the week. What are we doing on Friday, Matt?
Yeah, we got to figure out if we're going to do it basically like this, but I figured if we're all going to be in the Saratoga vicinity, why not kind of do a joint show between the Players Podcast and my show? We'll figure out timing, whether it'll be at 11 or 12, but, you know, we'll go over the races on Saturday at Saratoga and anything else that we want to chop up. So it'll be, you get all three of us twice in 1 week. Three times. If you want to go down on Saturday morning.
My booking you to, I said, and I'll recycle this joke for Saturday. Not a joke. It's really just an observation. But my birthday gift to myself, my birthday is Friday, but I'm sort of morphed Whitney Day into the official celebration. And my birthday gift to myself was to have you two as guests, because it's always so fun. And you know, I could basically just rely on you guys to do all the heavy lifting and just sit there, which is kind of what I'm in the mood for. Now, you've got a birthday this week too, Matt. Any special plans? Will you be up here in the spa to do some celebrating?
I will be going up through Massachusetts on Thursday. My birthday is Thursday. I'll go up to my parents' house, and then Friday morning I'll drive up to Saratoga, and then I'll be there until TBD. It's either going to be Saturday night or Sunday morning. I've got a 9:30 tea time in Massachusetts on Sunday morning, so I can't go crazy Saturday night if I do stay, but I'll probably end up staying there. So I just kind of look at it like it's birthday weekend, but I got to work on Saturday first.
It's the festival of us, man.
That's right.
The festival of us.
Early August, baby.
We're going to have a very good time this weekend in Saratoga. Come join us 11 o'clock on Saturday. All right, now it's time to put your guys' feet to the fire. JK, I'll start with you. Who is going to be the three-year-old champion?
Yoshida. No, I'm kidding. I don't. I'm hopeful. You know, I would honestly say that I think it's kind of cool that it's going to be this, but I would think whoever wins the Travers, I think it's kind of a reset now. Like, right, you just kind of say, okay, cluster, let's just clear what happened. If you can get us another win in the Travers, we'll give it to you. If you can have an impressive one in the Travers and we've never seen you before, we'll give it to you. You'll have one chance maybe to run the Jockey Club Gold Cup and prove us different, or win the Breeders' Cup Classic. But I think the Travers winner will be that. So we'll get three-year-old of the year, and I don't know who will be.
Matt, what's your on this?
I'm not trying to duck the question. I'm just going to try to lay out. I mean, you look at so many horses that they run in the Travers, or they run in the Pennsylvania Derby, now grade one, and it's going to go along with these three-year-olds. You have so many horses that have any other year would be fringe finalist sort of resumes. All of a sudden, they are front and center. So you can go through and you can list, if Cloud Computing rebounds, if we ever see Always Dreaming Again and he rebounds, if you have West Coast come over and win, if you have Practical Joke. I mean, look, Practical Joke, I know this is going to be just kind of an unconventional one, but let's just say he goes and wins the Allen Jerkins. Let's say he goes and wins I don't know, the Kelso, and then he comes back. Or heck, maybe he wins the Dirt Mile or the Cigar Mile. I mean, is that enough in a year like this where it's just been chop up the confetti, throw it up in the air, and however it lands, that's the next one? Would that be a stunner? Would Gervin all of a sudden be a stunner? The one that is all of a sudden sneaky is IRAP. If IRAP wins the Travers, I mean, you can go through. He's won the Bluegrass. He's won the Ohio Derby, the Indiana Derby. If he beats all these other common foes in the Travers, he has every right to take ownership of this thing. And the horse that no one seems to be talking about because we haven't heard from him since the Preakness, what if Classic Empire all of a sudden gets his act together? I mean, I don't know if he's been working, so I haven't checked the work tab, but if he won the Travers and then won one more race, isn't he 3-year-old champion? He's got the Arkansas Derby to his name.
What have you heard, JK?
I would also be sober this weekend if I didn't drink, but like... But that's definitely not going to happen, right?
It's one of those things where it's hard for me to sit there and be like, hey, I could give you six and maybe two of them would be finalists. I don't even have all three finalists. This year, I texted Illman after the GP. I said, let's agree that if something happens in the Haskell, we don't award a world champion this year. There isn't one. No, there isn't these horses that deserves to be called champion right now.
I vote for Matt, or not this time.
Exactly. I mean, it's been entertaining. And there's been no consistency whatsoever from these horses.
Thoughts? I think if they did the vote today, I think Always Dreaming would just by default, any chance you'd see that name there at the Eclipse Awards. JK, any chance
we talked about it before. I think it's always that's always the kind of default for when it comes to that award, you know, is if you win the Elk, well, okay, well, who won the Derby? But it does feel like this someone will have at least that much better of a resume that could surpass him. I think if they voted now, I mean, he would definitely be a finalist. And if you know, just kind of, you know, IRAP wins the Travers or West Coast wins the Travers, he would be a finalist, but I just don't see a world in which he wins in those situations.
And you know, I probably misspoke. There is one horse I think that can maybe not sew it up, but if Taprit were to win the Travers, he would be kind of hard to ignore and say, oh, okay, you know, you don't belong here. He would be kind of, I think he would be leader in the clubhouse if he won the Travers.
Your house isn't on fire, is it, Matt? Everything okay over there?
No, this is Upper West Side, baby. The sirens, they just go all the time.
I would think that Good Samaritan could, like, make a weird, really kind of tricky run at the thing if he, you know, comes back and wins the Travers, and then they can put him back on the grass. He can win another kind of big grass race. True. Or whatever. I mean, it's sneaky, but it's a possibility.
I don't think you can rule out the possibility of a 3-year-old winning the Classic, too. I mean, we just don't know at this point who's going to be there with the Arrogate situation, at least somewhat in my mind, up in the air. It's yet to be determined. I'm very glad Taprit's name came up, having that Triple Crown win coupled with something like a big run in the Travers. Let me ask you this. Is there any path to a 3-year-old? The 3-year-old award is not, is it broken out by sex or not?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Okay. So then that answers my question. I was just going to posit if it was a 3-year-old of the year, if there was any way Lady Aurelia could make a run at it, but not if it's broken out that way. But I mean, at this point,
she can't beat Abel Tasman would win if it was that was the case.
Well, and I mean, that's fair, though. I'm very interested to see what we see next from Lady Aurelia, but it sure sounds like the next start is not going to be on our shores anyway, and technically the voting that matters, the races that technically matter for the voting are the ones that happen on our shores. I was just thinking of the 3-year-old performances I've just seen with my eyes so far. Lady Aurelia is good as any of them. So it's going to be very interesting to see. Obviously, a story you can follow on the Matt Bernier Show, on the DRF Players Podcast, all the way until these awards are given in January. We'll get to Del Mar in a minute, but any thoughts? I know, JK, you had some interesting info/opinions on some of the younger horses that have made their debut Saratoga meet so far. Anything you care to share or comment on quick?
Not babies on Saturday, Sunday. We're good with Motivation. for Todd. It looks like that might be one of his best ones for the Zayats. And then I'm going to blank on the name all of a sudden. The
Separation chapter, of Powers.
Separation of Powers. Yeah, that was really impressive. You know, I was lucky enough to hang out with John. Duke talked about it the other day. Clocker, they call him Clocker John. And you know, he's there every morning watching these horses work. I think he's got one of the best opinions. And he thought the one was going to be better. The horse Separation of Powers longer. And so that's pretty exciting to think that there's going to be an improvement from her as she kind of stretches out. And so those two were really nice ones to kind of get you excited. One of the fun things about Saratoga is getting excited for what's to come with some of these young horses.
I feel bad. We're going to end up giving Del Mar a little bit of short shrift here, but let's go ahead and move to the other coast. And I want to talk about what I can only describe as a bizarre running of the Bing Crosby. JK, you revealed before that it worked out, that half of your bet worked out okay. But Matt, what were your thoughts on that race and just how unusual the stretch drive was?
Yeah, I mean, I probably owe Dre Fong a shipment of mints for the help that he gave, because I had Ransom the Moon as well. No, I mean, it's unfortunate for the people connected to Dre Fong that he just, you know, when he saw the gap, he tried to duck into it. And I mean, it's good that he seems to be fine and that obviously Smith is fine, but it's hard for me to sit here. I love Ransom the Moon. Ever since D'Amato's gotten him on dirt, he really looks like a quality sprinter. It's also hard for me, though, to sit here and think that Roy H. didn't run a little bit better just because the interference that was, you know, kind of run in front of him when he was floated 6, 7, 8 paths off the rail, and he still only lost by a length and change. I think Roy H. is one. I know Peter Miller's had some squabbles with the people in Southern California, but Roy H. to me, I mean, didn't he kind of look like a Breeders' Cup sprint kind of horse?
Got a little bit of that look for sure, and being carried that wide, and Ransom Moon winning right up the rail. Objectively, JK, who was best in the Bing Crosby, and what do you think of Roy H.'s prospects going forward, as Matt was saying?
Oh, I think Roy H. was best, for sure. But I'm not convinced that Dre Fong wouldn't have won that situation. I don't think, you know, Ransom the Moon probably wouldn't have got through as easy as he did with Dre Fong being down on the inside, because he broke well. I know some people have talked about how Dre Fong hasn't always been the sharpest out of the gate. He broke well and was going in the right direction until he took that little turn. So, I think Roy H. was best. I want to see him run one more race. Thought he was with the track at Belmont. I know Duke talked about that on Friday as well. So he ran, but he did run well on Saturday. So I just want to see. And the late money, by the way, let's not forget about that. If anyone did notice, Roy H. went off favored.
Yeah.
Against the Breeders' Cup sprint champ, who had A-minus workouts on his workout report, and Ransom the Moon, who everyone that I know thought was going to win, who was bet down to you know, 5-2 or whatever. And Roy H. went off favored into the teeth of that, which I think is something that needs to be taken into consideration.
It'll be interesting to follow these sprinters from here. Hopefully Dre Fong will get a fair shot. You know, you see that so often, these horses without, whether they're breaking without the rail there, out of chutes, or what is there anything that can be done from like a safety / fairness point of view to ensure more of a fair start sometimes in these one turn sprint races on fair tracks? Or is it just part of the game? You just have to accept and deal with and be an astute trip maker and figure out when it matters and when it doesn't. What do you think about that, Matt?
I mean, maybe this, I don't know how, you know, the inner workings of a racetrack and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, I'm thinking at Santa Anita, when they start, you know, 1.25 mile, 1.5 mile races going down the hill, isn't there a temporary rail that goes between the actual turn of the turf course? When they come down the hill, they cross over the dirt. Isn't there a rail that they eventually take down as the horses go down the front side into the first turn? I mean, if that's the case, why couldn't you just have a temporary rail come out from the chute, connect to the main track rail on the backside, and then when there's a two-turn race, just take the rail down?
What do you think of that idea, JK?
Problem solved.
Simple? I mean, they've been doing this a long time. You'd like to think that somebody would have come up with it by now.
Oh, racing? Nothing's ever simple in racing.
Well, you know what? They do that extender, like when they come out of the chute, the turf chute, from the infield at Del Mar. They have that little extender that they have it back for when they're coming out of the chute, and they pull it out so when they come down the turn, it extends. Come out of the stretch, they kind of extend that pole a little bit. That probably makes no sense, but it seems they have a lot of temporary situations. I would think that they could probably figure something out.
We should ask some people who are a little closer to the situation, but it is certainly true, as Matt was intimating, that very often in racing, when you ask why something is done a certain way, the answer you hear is, well, we've always done it that way, as opposed to necessarily thinking about what the big picture is and what makes the most sense. So something to at least do a little bit of following up on. JK, what did you think about the Clemenel Hirsch? I'm sure you got a chance to see that one live.
Yeah, no, we were outside on like the sixth floor where the tournament was, and kind of standing. It's really, you're right above the kind of the gate, but you're really high up. And I thought it was so fascinating when they broke from the gate. You heard about six whip cracks, and when I looked down, when I heard the first one, my eyes were like, "Where's that coming from?" And it was Victor wearing out Stellar Wind's shoulder to get her into the race, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Because unfortunately, that poor mare keeps running into these paceless races, and she's adaptable enough that she can run being, you know, involved in a race. She did it against Beholder, and she did it against Valdori, staying close. If she ever gets a real pace to run into, she's going to be tough. And I feel like there's a filly at some point that will provide her a real pace to run into, and I feel like Stellar Wind would get the best of that deal.
What did you think of the race, Matt?
Yeah, agreed. You know, I think Stellar Wind is just, you know, better than Valdori, and that's not a knock against Valdori. She's very talented. I'd like to turn her back for the filly and mare sprint of an eights, but I just kind of feel like with Songbird, and even with, you know, Forever Unbridled moves forward in her start, I think Stellar Wind is the horse to beat in that division right now. And like Jonathan said, if she's winning these races, kind of being taken out of her game, I think she'd like to sit two or three lengths off of it and make that one run, and instead she can't because she hasn't had any pace to run at in these spots. I think she's like a fine wine. She's getting better with age.
Beautiful to see, really. Couple of fun things to wrap the show today. I realized for this contest that I'm about to present, I didn't find the date. So what I'm going to do while I search for the date of the prize, JK, I told you enough about it. You can give the audience some idea of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we had a listener, and if I botch it, Pete will clean it up. But we had a listener who has a box, I think towards the end of the meet at Saratoga, and wasn't going to be able to use it, doesn't want to give it back, and has donated it to us to give to a listener. And so we're going to have I think we're going to just keep it simple, and we're going to repost this. Maybe we'll save it for Friday since we had the technical errors. I'll let Pete decide before we do it, but just retweet we'll have a retweet contest. You retweet it. If we'll just randomly pick somebody to have the box. And that's a ton of fun. We really appreciate that donation so we can give it back to the listener.
You're underestimating our crack tech team. When the people who download the show on iTunes hear it, it's going to sound completely seamless, JK. So I think we should just go ahead and do it for this week. And I've just got to find the date, and then I'll share that.
We got 3 minutes. I do want to tell a funny story.
Tell your funny story.
So Saturday night we go to a restaurant called the Market. It's not the Market right by the track at Del Mar where they have the good cheese bread that Baffert always talks about. It's like down the road. It's not that far. But anyways, we go there. Me, Nick, John Nichols, we're sitting there having dinner. And in comes Mike Smith and the Zenyatta team. Mr. Moss, Sheriffs, the whole thing, because they had played, apparently there's a documentary about Zenyatta's life that they debuted at Del Mar after the races. You could sit in the paddock and watch it. Cool. Obviously Nick wasn't very into that. Nick being a blame guy and an East is best guy. He wasn't into sticking around. So he takes advantage of the fact that I've had a couple of drinks. I busted out of the tournament. I'm feeling a little bit down. I'm having a nice beer, Pete, you would have enjoyed. And he waits till he gets me just a little bit loose, and he says, he looks at me and he says, Jonathan, you know, he goes, I don't remember what his exact wording was, but he goes, essentially he said, you know, you're soft if you don't go over there and show them your Zenyatta tattoo. They were literally at the table next to us.
For sure.
Yeah. So he sets me up. He acts like they're all acting like they're going to walk over there with me. I had to put some like butter on my elbow because it was so ashy. It's a dark skin problem. And I go over and I show it to him and I look behind me and Nick and John are like really far away from me. They're not even, they're completely left me in this, like coming to approach this table of like 12 people to show off my tattoo. But Mr. Voss was really excited and Mr. Sheriff was excited to see. They were shocked. And Mike was like, look, he's even got her cotton in her ear. So then some lady gave me a round of applause, which I thought was fun. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure. So I'm sure Nick, and then Nick obviously tweeted about it, making fun of me, seen somewhere in Del Mar, Jonathan showing his tattoo off.
I think it sounds awesome. I think he did you a favor sending you over there. That must have been an awesome experience to get to meet that crew and show them that amazing. That's not just any horse tattoo. That is a fantastic rendering that really looks just like her. I think they must have. I think it was a good thing for everybody. No.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I don't get me wrong. I was glad. I thought I had support. I was by myself, kind of like in college when I started a fight and I looked around and no one was with me.
Let's hope that scene doesn't repeat itself at the Paddock Bar this coming weekend. It was great to get a chance to meet a whole bunch more listeners. Special thank you goes out to Adam, who saw some of us doing the boozy milkshake routine and wanted to get in on it and ended up buying the table a round of boozy milkshakes. I've figured out the proper way of doing it. It's one milkshake and three shots of whiskey, and then you divide the one milkshake among the three whiskeys. You get the right amount of booze and milkshake. The consistency is good, and you don't end up with too much ice cream. Though if you're Jonathan Kitchen, I'm not sure that there's ever a thing as too much ice cream.
Yeah, no, for sure. I thought we did rum. I'm doing rum.
You can do rum. I tried both rum and whiskey. The whiskey was a little more to my palate. The rum was a little sweet, but you're right. The original version was the rum milkshake. This time I was doing it with bourbon. You kind of can't, if you've got booze and you've got milkshake, you kind of can't go wrong. Matt Bernier, what are the odds that we'll see you with a birthday boozy milkshake with some Jack Daniels in it over the weekend?
I got stomach problems, so there's no ice cream in this future, but the booze will certainly happen.
All right, we'll just put some Coke in yours, and we'll deal with it that way. All right, that is all the time we have. I could not find a date for the Silly Box, so we will go with JK's original advice. We will make that something we do when we post the Friday show. I'll get my ducks in a row by then. I want to thank Matt Bernier for taking time out and joining us today. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin, as always. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank Craig in advance for the annoying editing he's going to have to do on this file to make it post cleanly to iTunes. We will be back on Friday. Time to be announced. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.